Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we're here with the one and only...
Edward Norton.
Who is the writer and director and star of the new film, Motherless Brooklyn, which hits theaters November 1st. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Pleasure.
All right, so let's start. It was a book that came out like in the late 90s. When did you actually get your hand on it and say, you know, I'm envisioning this in my head?
I read it before most people because I got it in galleys before it was published, actually.
Awesome. And immediately, I mean, I'm sure as you're reading it, are you you're a student of film history and stuff. Are you immediately thinking, all right, this is like my Chinatown here, you know, instead of L.A. Water. And I mean that as a compliment. L.A. Water and Power, we have New York Borough Authority, you know, Alec Baldwin's kind of the known cross, you know, that's the first thing I thought of when I was watching the movie. So was any of that percolating in you as you're reading it or shooting it?
Well, no, because none of that's in the book. The book takes place in 1999.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the resetting it in the 50s and building in the plot about what was going on in the mid 50s with discrimination in housing and kind of some this fairly brutal autocrat who ran New York in that period. Was kind of the shadow dictator of New York in the 50s. That's a complete departure from the book. The book is about a detective with Tourette's syndrome and obsessive compulsive disorder who's working to solve the mystery of the killing of his only friend.
Okay.
But
you expanded it into that.
Yeah, but the book it's the most wonderful character. It immediately hooks you on page one. You're kind of His condition is really unusual and it's funny and yet it's poignant and he's got brilliant special gifts because of his condition, but then it also trips him up and makes the world hard to navigate. People treat him badly, but you're in the book, you're inside his head, so you know kind of the real him, and then you also watch him kind of navigate this his own personal difficulties. That's what I loved, and but the book also has kind of it's hard to explain. It's a surreal. It's in the 90s, but these guys live in kind of this pocket of Brooklyn that feels like the 50s. And ultimately, the author gave me his blessing to just sort of reset it in the actual 50s.
Why did you want to make that change? Or just that rich with the shadow puppeteer kind of a deal?
Yes, there were. To me, there was a story that, the character could be this great vehicle for going into some of these murky histories that I think are fairly resonant with what's going on in the world right now. But also it's a tough thing to explain. In the book, they really feel like guys who have never left the 50s, but film is much more literal, and if you do that on film, you could be like, it could feel like the Blues Brothers, like guys in fedoras in the mud, and you just go, do we want it to feel tongue in cheek? And we didn't. Sure. We wanted to play it emotionally straight,
right.
You know.
Right, right. Absolutely. Was there any tie, because I've always known that, you know, you were always looking for the local angle. I know you grew up in Columbia, Maryland, and that was like one of the first planned communities in D.C. Was that echoing your mind at all about, you know, the idea of these different boroughs? I mean, did that play into your fascination with that topic at all, you think?
Yeah, not Columbia per se, but my grandfather was this very progressive urban planner, James Rouse, and he conceived Columbia and built Columbia, but that was sort of an outgrowth of his conviction that that people were leaving cities because cities weren't being cared for, paid attention to, made renewed and made vibrant. And this was the kind of the cause of his life. And later in his life, he was very, very driven to take on the affordable housing crisis. Mm-hmm. The inspiration was more, I worked for him. I knew, you know, I was very immersed in his work, and there's a lot of his values and his view are expressed in Willem Dafoe's character. Anyone who's in this area, who's familiar with my granddad and his idealism, and would be would be very familiar with some of the things being expressed by Willem Dafoe's character.
It's Willem Dafoe's granddad, in a way, you know.
Yeah. No, there's certain lines that are straight out of my granddad's mouth. Yeah,
I love it. Well, and they say right what you know, right? So that's freaking awesome. You mentioned the character, the Tourette's and everything. Talk about why, you know, you said you saw that in the book and that's what hooked you. Talk about actually crafting those, you know, in terms of acting choices, like how do you decide what to do? And, you know, you don't want to, it's tricky. You don't want to play it for laughs in the wrong times, but there are moments where you can, you know, just explain sort of, you know, how you tackle a character like that. Because like you mentioned earlier, his constantly going mind, I have a little bit myself. It allows you to him to crack the case. You know what I mean? That's it's also a benefit to him. So. Right. But acting choice wise, how are you deciding which little things to, you know, how to burst out? You know?
Well, I mean, first off, I actually think the most insulting thing you can do in depicting any kind of unique condition or even affliction, if you want to call it that, you know, disability, whatever wrapper you want to put on it. I think the worst thing to do is to take away the complex humanity of anybody, and if you reduce someone to nothing but their condition, that's not respectful. Like, it's sort of like I think the reason My Left Foot, for instance, is a great film is that's the whole point is, yes, he has this condition, but he's also a real jerk to a lot of people, and he's funny, and he, you know, and the whole point is that he refused to be defined by it, right? That's why it's a great story. It's about he's not heroic because he had a disability. Right. He's heroic because he refused it in a way. I think that the other thing is that Tourette's syndrome in particular is not very easily quantifiable. It's very different in each person. Some people have very mild physical manifestations of it only. Some people have... the vocal components of it, the compulsion to say certain things repetitively.
There's a little OCD in there too. Picking at the thread.
But some people have Tourette's and components of OCD. Some do not. Some just literally have physical twitches, or they have the what's called echolalia, which is the impulse to shout out certain things. What I felt was that I wanted to create sort of a mashup of it that's all his own, which is in some ways accurate because everybody's expressions of Tourette's are very unique and personal. So there's a number of good documentary films about people with the condition. Those are enormously helpful because you get to see a wide variety of people and in some ways say, oh, that's an interesting component. And I've met a few people with varying degrees of intensity of the condition, and I think to me what was almost as important as getting that right is depicting that condition or no condition, he's a person who needs to grow up a little bit. He's, as he says, sort of been so wrapped up in his own problems that he's never honestly summoned up the moral courage to think bigger, care about other people, get outside his own skin. And and when he meets this young Black woman who herself deals with discrimination, being marginalized, she's a lawyer, but people think she's a secretary. But she is fighting. She is spending her life trying to make things better for other people. And in a way, through her, he ends up going, you know, what's my friggin' excuse? I'm giving myself a pass, and I'm ultimately being apathetic. And to me, that's the thing too. Is you want to see, it's great to root for an underdog. I think we all like to root for an underdog. That's what's wonderful, honestly, about films like Forrest Gump or Rain Man. Mm-hmm. I think, though the characters are extreme, what they do is they remind us it's nice to be empathetic. It's nice to root for people, you know?
Sure.
But in a way, too, what you want to see the character themselves grow. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because I think we live in a world where, in all honesty, entertainment is a great thing. But sometimes I think that people unconsciously, they want more nourishing depictions of people. They want things. People don't only want like high fructose corn syrup. They don't want it. It's nice to sit back in a chair and watch other people sort of swoop in tights and save the world. Sure. But the truth is like, I think people are more, ultimately, it's more satisfying for all of us to see films where we're not passive, where we can see ourselves in it, and they provoke us to think a little bit about ourselves and see ourselves in characters who have to push themselves to rise.
Right.
And that, I think, is honestly, I think we connect in a deeper and more human way with those stories where we see a more humble and realistic kind of version of heroism, if that makes any sense.
I'm with you. And that's coming from the Hulk right there, so, who got out of it on the ground floor, if you want to say. Staying on topic, directing-wise, when you're casting Alec, is it any coincidence you're casting the guy that goes on SNL playing Trump in such a role? Like that swimming pool scene in that, him in that robe, that's exactly what I'm thinking about that whole time.
Yeah, I don't... Alec is such a fine dramatic actor. He always has been. I'm older than you, but if you came up on movies like Glengarry Glen Ross, Alec is not only a really great stage actor and dramatic actor, he has a command of language that is really extraordinary. And when I watch this, he reminds me of some of those great, you know, mid-century actors like Lee J. Cobb those people who had a facility with language that lets them take very... Orson Welles, honestly. Yeah, yeah. He reminds me of like Orson Welles and Citizen Kane. He has that kind of heft, kind of old world...
Or Lee J. Cobb, Union Boss, on the waterfront,
12 Angry Men.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel a kind of a lethal, powerful sense of his capacity to intimidate, to bully, but his intellectual force at the same time.
Sure.
And there's not a lot of people like that. Yeah. So obviously, like, the character he plays is an intellectual giant as well as a power broker, and the direct comparisons to, you know, insane clowns are limited. I think, you know what I mean, that to me Alec is this, the fact that Alec is a great satirist and a great comedian doesn't undercut for me what he's, in a way, my original relationship with Alec is as a great dramatic actor. And honestly, I think the most amazing thing is that there's very few people who do them both that well.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's really thrilling to see him in that dark gear. You know, I think it's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, I'm thinking, again, it's a compliment to the performance and everything in the role, but I'm thinking John Huston, Noah Cross right there. And
that, yeah, so, no, I love well, that. Yes, I love I think, that. I think that sense of people for whom other people have become inconvenient, you know, whose power and wealth has led them to a place where they have, there's no apology, no sense of self-consciousness about the naked, brutal sort of assertion that they can do what they want. You know what I mean?
He even says, I'm not just above the law, I'm ahead of the law. Right. The law will adapt to me eventually.
Exactly, yeah. And I think too, you know, without giving it all away, I think, you know, I think I was very interested in the psychology of, to me, he's like a Darth Vader. And by that, I mean, he was a Jedi. He had the capacity to bring his incredible talents into the good and has become so seduced by ultimately by total control that he's applying his gifts in a dark way, which I think happens, you know. And I think, and then of course, people who become that powerful, it tends to metastasize and express itself in other forms of brutality, with which, you know, I don't want to give away plot points in the film, but I think that's part of it, is that we're seeing, you know, I mean, I think you referenced Chinatown. What's great about Chinatown, I think, is it illuminates, remember, it's about the 30s in LA, right? But it's made in 1974, 75. And it really, you know, it's this moment where I think a lot of Americans were saying, you know, we've essentially, like, the military industrial complex has completely lied to us about this war that we're now pulling out of.
It was the year of Watergate, with
and Watergate is unspooling, and it's sort of like, you know, the film says, hey, you know, by looking at the past, by looking at, you know, the dark shadow narrative that was under the sunny LA of the American dream, we distill something about what's going on right now too. We remind ourselves, hey, that this has always been a function. This has always been part of the shadow narrative.
Right.
And what I love about it is, I think in a lot of these films, Bogart, Nicholson, the detective kind of stands for all of us. He wanders into that shadow narrative and, like all of us, kind of goes, hey, you know what? This is starting to irritate me. Like, right. I'm going to start sticking a fork in you, because the detective is the one who says, you know, how much of this do you expect us to tolerate before we start, you know, before we start protesting in a way, where you're going to make me mad, you know what I mean? And I think...
even if we have to lose our noses.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I think, but that's the healthy, that's where, to me, it's good to be reminded that at certain points, we have to be the ones who say, how much is enough?
Sure.
How much of this do you expect us to let you, how much are, do you think we're going to let you play us as Americans before we say, nah, this isn't the way it goes here. Sure. You know what I mean? And I think that's
what the genre, so great about this genre.
And, you know, LA Confidential too. A lot of ways, it's not, that's what's so, if you said to 99 out of 100 people right now, like, who loved LA Confidential, they couldn't tell you what the plot is. I don't really remember the plot. What you remember is that when you drop into it, you realize the music, the performances, the way it looks, everything, it works a kind of hypnosis, and suddenly you go, whoa, this is not kitschy, this is not cliche, this is not, you know, kind of like tongue-in-cheek, or this is like, this has got guts, and it's real, and I feel like I've gone through a portal, and I'm back in that moment, and you're just like, it flips some switch in your head, in my head, when I watch those movies, and I go, just take me wherever you want to go. I'm in. Like, this looks great. This sounds great.
Right.
These are actors with weight and guts, and wherever you're going, I'm just happy to be here. You know, that's what I think is kind of great about those classic films, and that's what we were trying to make.
I mean, it's on the QT and very hush hush. I know we're on the clock, and but my listeners are gonna kill me if I don't ask. Next week, 20th anniversary Fight Club. Tuesday or something. 99.
It was October.
Just real quick memories, or, you know, one of the greatest twists ever. You know, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. But just playing a role that, you know, are you and Pitt working together, like trying to have you have some of the same mannerisms, just little shades of it. No. You know what I mean? Or,
no, I think
the whole Tyler Durden thing. Yeah,
I guess there's aspects of it that it's sort of blink and you miss it kind of stuff, but the aficionados of it have found the places that Fincher put, like, you know, single frame or two frame pops of Tyler appearing in the mind as an idea before he actually appears. I think, but, you know, I think that there was a group of people working on that, not just me and Brad, obviously, David.
Genius.
Andy Walker, Helena, terrific designers, Jeff Cronin with one of the great contemporary cinematographers, and we were kind of all the same age. We were all, I think, you know, marinating in the sensation that there were things that people our age were struggling with, you know, and Chuck's book caught this. Chuck's book just caught, like, was like a, like, tapped this vein, you know. And I think we almost just felt like we just have to, we have to take what he's caught and get it right. We've got to, we got to turn this into something that expresses the moment that we're living in as we feel it right now. And, you know, I don't mean be exclusionary and say, you know, this is the wrong way, but we were making it for our friends, for ourselves, for, it was for people of a certain age. And when, and in a lot of ways, I think, as Fincher said, if we didn't piss some people off, we didn't go far enough, you know? And I think we knew not everybody was going to get the joke, but in a way that's part of what makes it more fun in some ways.
Everybody gets it now. So again, everybody, Edward Norton, Motherless Brooklyn, November 1st. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah. Come out and see it.